Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye.
It's 29 minutes after 9 o'clock. We are going to be waiting for a call from Richard Marles. Essentially, he's over in Western Australia at the moment, and he's getting in a car, apparently, to go somewhere to whatever meetings or whatever they've got organised, and they're 2 hours behind us in Western Australia. So he's actually going to ring us, and that should be in the next couple of minutes or so as the federal member for Corio. I'm looking forward to speaking to him about a number of different issues, including... We'll speak to him about his move to the defence portfolio, but I also want to speak to him about things like the same-sex marriage plebiscite. I've got a feeling he won't agree with what I said before, but that's all right. And also, what is it going to be like trying to work with the Senate? I mean, the Labor Party is probably laughing all the way to the bank, as it were, with this. I think they're going to have a great time in the Senate because it's going to be very hard for the government to get its legislation through. And I was at the G21 Stakeholder Forum on Friday, and what a great event that was. Kerry O'Brien was speaking, and he made the point that the government was going to be required to get 9 out of the 11 crossbenchers to support their legislation. So if Labor said no to anything, you would have to get 9 out of 11. And that also assumes that the Greens say no. So of that 9, you've got to get Pauline Hanson and Nick Xenophon to agree. And I think those two come from different ends of the political spectrum, not to say that Nick Xenophon's far out to one side or the other. But I feel like getting those to agree in the same room is going to be a little bit challenging. And Richard Marles is now on the line, the federal member for Corio, recently re-elected. Richard, good morning.
Good morning, Mitchell. How are you?
Very well. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I understand you're over in Western Australia.
I'm in Perth this morning, on my way to HMAS Stirling, which is a base just south of Perth. So it's a couple of hours earlier here, but a beautiful sunny morning in Perth.
And it's very nice here as well, so we're doing well. Tell us about the move that you've recently undertaken to the Shadow Defence portfolio. Of course, you were the Shadow Minister for Immigration and Border Protection for quite some time, but you've taken up the role of Shadow Defence.
Yeah, well, I'm very excited about the opportunity that Bill Shorten's given me in terms of becoming the Shadow Defence Minister. It's an area which has always been of interest to me. It obviously is central to the national security space, and that's been a long-standing interest of mine. And working in foreign affairs, as I did in the last term of the Labor government, you get a close look at defence, but it's different, obviously, being a part of it. And I'm really looking forward to learning about defence more and seeing, you know, the Australian servicemen and women and what they do up close and the fantastic contribution they make to our country.
My point earlier on in the program was that there seems to be a bit more bipartisanship on defence between the two major parties than perhaps some of the other portfolios. Would that be right?
Yeah, I think that's true over the journey. I mean, there are... You can find areas of difference, but by and large, national security has been an area where both the major political parties have been in agreement, and more to the point, try to be in agreement, in that it obviously is so important that it needs to be kept above the political fray. And it's not that areas of partisanship aren't important, of course they are, but it's also that the kinds of things which divide Labor and Liberal, our view on the economy, our view on whether government should be big or small in the way in which it works with the economy, these are not the sorts of issues which divide us in relation to questions of national security. So ultimately, I think you're right, there is a lot more bipartisanship around this space.
And what is the current state of play in the defence portfolio? Obviously, you've got the current minister in Maurice Payne. How's she going?
Well, what, of course, the government have done, which is an interesting step since the election, is, in a sense, to split the portfolio up. So you do have Maurice Payne as the Defence Minister, but you now have Christopher Pyne as the Defence Industry Minister, and he's looking at questions around the industry side of building equipment, which Defence procures, which Defence buys. So around questions of submarines and indeed, as an example, and Land 400, which of course has been of interest to people in Geelong. That's an area which now it seems to be being dealt with by the Defence Industry Minister. So this is something which hasn't really been done in that way before, where you've got those two ministers both sitting in cabinet operating, and how that will work, of course, I guess we will all see. At the end of the day, I end up being the shadow of both of them because my role is the more traditional conception of how a defence minister has been, and that is, or a shadow defence minister, and that is to cover both the areas of national strategic interest as well as how you prepare for that in terms of the equipment that you buy and the equipment that you build.
Yeah, I see that makes a bit of sense. Obviously, you've got Christopher Pyne there as the Defence Industry Minister, as you've said, and obviously he comes from South Australia, and South Australia seems to have been the centre of attention lately when it comes to building those new submarines. And, you know, obviously Geelong missed out on the Land 400 project, it seems, which is disappointing. Do you think that the South Australian submarine decision has been to save seats in South Australia?
Well, what I think needs to be the case going forward is that the way in which we engage in procurement for defence and the way in which we the defence industry operates has to be first and foremost in the national interest, and it shouldn't be dictated by political concerns. I mean, if you look at, for example, the Land 400 decision and the delay in making the announcement about the reduction of the bidders down to the existing shortlist now, which of course has had the effect that the bid that had the biggest Geelong component is now no longer part of this process. That decision was due much earlier this year. It ended up being delayed until after the election, and it really does peak the question as to why that was the case, given that it was, in fact, you know, just about the worst kept secret around defence industry traps, that the bid containing the Geelong component was not likely to be successful. I think there's a real question as to what the member for Corangamite knew prior to the election about the prospects of Geelong being successful with a Land 400 bid, given the degree to which she personally was championing Land 400, and I think peddled a lot of false hope to people in Geelong who quite, you know, rightly have had difficult times with the decisions of Alcoa and Ford, and we need a proper jobs policy in Geelong, but all we got was this false hope that was being peddled by Sarah Henderson. So I think when you look at that, what we really need to ensure is that the way in which defence industry operates has to be above that kind of politics and has to operate in the national interest, and that goes to all the decisions that are made. And we're talking about massive decisions, Mitchell, like the Land 400, $10 billion procurement. The submarines, by some measures, are the largest procurement in Australian history. These are tens of billions of dollars of money which is being spent. It has to be done in a proper way and in the national interest.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Were there reasons why the Geelong area missed out on the Land 400 project? You know, was it really set up to fail from the very beginning just because we weren't suited to it?
Firstly, these are questions which obviously go to the way in which the bidders put forward their plans and don't necessarily go to the question of location. I actually do think Geelong does have a role it can play in the defence industry space, and our history, well, firstly our location, but secondly our history in terms of manufacturing and having Deakin University in Geelong, which provides us with a lot of high-tech research that has occurred at that university, are all ingredients which make Geelong a good place for defence industry activity to occur. But I think, you know, this is a longer-term plan than has been suggested, in my view, by the member for Corangamite and others within the Geelong space. And I just think that, you know, we need to be really pushing this as hard as we can. And all we saw from the member for Corangamite, as I said earlier, was really peddling false hope.
Now, I wanted to just touch on the election result. Obviously, you got a swing towards you in Corio, which I think people probably expected would happen. But were you disappointed not to win Corangamite?
Oh, well, of course. I mean, we worked very hard. Libby Coker, who was our candidate in Corangamite, I think, did a fine job, and we were obviously very hopeful of winning that seat. But it's we never underestimated the challenge in relation to this. It's a hard seat to win. There is a formidable opponent in Sarah Henderson, who currently holds the seat, and none of us for a moment were imagining it was some kind of foregone conclusion. It was always a big fight, and I think when it's all said and done, Libby Coker can hold her head up high and feel very proud of what she did during the campaign and achieving a swing to Labor in that seat. But you know, I think I felt happy with the way in which Labor fared in Geelong. In the electorate of Corio, we achieved a swing which was greater than the state average, and that was very gratifying. And I think it says again that the policies of the coalition since the election of the Abbott-Turnbull government have simply not been policies which are in the interests of people in Geelong. I mean, we've seen a massive loss of industry during that period of time. We've seen significant funding cuts to Beacon. And when you look at people who during that period need the social safety net more than ever before, we've seen significant cuts to that as well. So in many respects, I think this is a government which has left Geelong behind, and that was reflected in the way in which people voted on election day.
But if that's the case, there's been some speculation that state government issues played a role in Labor not securing more seats, like, for example, winning Corangamite and perhaps even losing Chisholm. Do you think that state government issues played a role?
Look, I think that's overstated in my view. I mean, obviously you're referring to the CFA issue. It wasn't helpful that there was so much attention provided to it, but I've got to say, I spoke to a lot of CFA volunteers during the election. I think they understood that this was an issue that was being manipulated by the coalition. Many of the volunteers I spoke to were quite resentful of that and actually didn't want to be a part of that kind of campaign. Certainly when you look at the booths where you would have expected to see a particular swing associated with the CFA dispute, there was no swing eventuated. So I actually don't think it had a huge effect at the end of the day. If it had an effect at all, it was to a degree a distraction, that's for sure. But I don't actually think there were many people who went to the ballot box on the day and voted on that issue.
Now, the same-sex marriage plebiscite, I mean, I understand that you have a different point of view and that you feel like it should be just up to a conscience vote in the parliament. But either way, it must be good news that this issue is finally going to be resolved, it looks like, in February next year.
Well, all of us, of course, not all of us, but I certainly would like same-sex marriage to be the law of the land. My view is that that's where the country is now at, and that we shouldn't be discriminating against people on the basis of their sexual preference, and same-sex couples ought to have the same rights and status accorded to their relationship as anyone else within our community. Now, that's very much strongly my view, and when legislation has previously gone before the parliament, that's the way in which I voted. My view now is that that's what we ought to do as politicians, vote on this. We should certainly save the money of this opinion poll, because it's not a referendum, there's no binding nature to it. Indeed, many in the coalition have seemed to hedge their bets as to whether they would even go along with the outcome of the plebiscite. I think there is rightly some concern amongst many as to what kind of sentiments will be unleashed as a result of the plebiscite. We've seen former Justice Michael Kirby make comments along those lines in the last 48 hours, and I can understand why members of the gay community would be very anxious about the kind of hate speech which might come as a result of this. My view is we should just get on with it. We're elected to make decisions. We're elected to vote in the parliament on legislation. This is squarely the kind of legislation that would go through a parliament. To me, it feels like a waste of time, a waste of money, and it does raise a whole lot of dangers along with it.
Now, just last of all, this issue of budget repair, it seems to be the issue that won't go away. And Matthias Coleman has come out and made some comments about whether Bill Shorten was or wasn't going to support different cuts or savings in the Senate. I mean, the Senate is a bit of a nightmare in and of itself, isn't it, where you've got to get the support of 9 out of the 11 crossbenchers if the Labour Party and the Greens decide to say no to any legislation. So the government's going to find it very difficult to pass anything without your support, isn't it?
Well, the Senate, in many respects, is, of course, of the government's own making.
Yep.
I mean, this is we have Paul Hanson in the Senate because of the arrangement that the Greens political party and the government entered into in terms of Senate reform, and people should never forget that. And listeners to your program who might support the Greens should never forget what the Greens are responsible for in this respect. So, you know, the government, in a sense, have made a rod for its own back in relation to this. But there is a whole lot of hot air from the government in respect of this question of budget repair. And I think the reason we are seeing a lot of sound and light from the government right now around this is to distract from their own issues around questions of budget repair, and particularly in relation to superannuation, where they are hopelessly divided. And that, of course, is a measure which is there as a budget save, which is part of the budget repair process, but they can't get it through their own party room, let alone get to a point of putting a proposition to the Parliament. But we made it clear immediately prior to the election that we would support a number of cuts to the budget. Now, these were difficult decisions that we made. It's never popular to support questions of budget cuts, but we understand the fiscal imperative of getting the budget back into structural surplus over a period of time. And we've made it clear that the position that we took to the election is the position that we will support during this term of Parliament. We couldn't have made that more clear. And we're absolutely willing to sit down with the government and talk to them about every one of those proposals. Now, we've been saying things as plainly as that for the last week. The government refuses to listen to that because they want to try and, rather than seek bipartisanship, they want to try and politically position us. And the only point that we've made is that before signing the dotted line, we would actually like to have a look at the legislation which is being put before the Parliament. That's reasonable, and that's what people would expect of us who voted for us, to actually have a look at legislation before we vote for it in the Parliament. Now, that's the only thing we've said, and on the basis of saying that, there's all this noise from the government about how we might be walking away from our commitments. We're not doing that at all. We make commitments before the election. We will honour them. They will be the way in which we act during this term of Parliament. We're absolutely up for budget repair.
Well, Richard, it promises to be a very interesting term of Parliament. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. And also, you've agreed to come on a regular basis once a month, which we really appreciate. So we look forward to catching up with you in September.
Yeah, me too. Look forward a lot to it. Thanks, Mitch.
Good on you. Richard Miles there, the federal member for Corio, recently re-elected for what must be, 2007 was the first time. So it'd be his fourth time getting re-elected into the House of Representatives as the member for Corio, and obviously had no trouble whatsoever in holding that seat. Interesting to hear some of the commentary about the defence portfolio. I mean, as he said, a lot of bipartisanship, but at the same time, a lot of money spent on that portfolio as well, and particularly on those submarines in South Australia. It is coming up to 12 minutes to 10 o'clock. Of course, after 10 o'clock, we'll speak to Wiley Sims from Smartline. We'll also have Alison Afries coming in to tell us about the Rio Olympics and was the money worth it and were the Olympics good and how did they compare to some of the speculation before the Olympics started, which was, of course, quite negative. You know, did it actually turn out to be as bad? Can we walk away and say this was a great Olympics? Well, we'll speak to her after 10:30 on that issue. But after the break, we'll be joined by program technical commentator Trent Geddes. He will be telling us about a massive problem that's come through with Windows 10. I mean, you'd think that this whole update thing would have been sorted out by now, but some people have been forcibly updated to Windows 10, and it's caused some pretty big issues. And also, he's got a couple of other innovations in the airline world that he wants to talk to us about as well. So that's coming up straight after the break.
Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye. Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 till 11 on 94.7 The Pulse.